welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you are enjoying your day. Coming up, Matt Olean and I will dive into Gladiator 2, Ridley Scott's highly anticipated sequel to the iconic original. With reactions ranging from praise for its visuals to debates over its narrative, we'll hear what Matt thinks. And later, Dave Thompson and I will review this week's major news stories. But first, we preview the 98th Annual Concordia College Christmas Concert, Our Eyes at Last Shall See Him. Directed by Michael Culleton, this festive tradition features over 300 student musicians from five ensembles performing in harmony with a magnificent new mural. The concert will be performed in Memorial Auditorium on the campus of Concordia College at 7:30 p.m. Friday, December 6th, at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, December 7th, and at 2 p.m. Sunday, December 8th. And then the concert will be taken on the road to Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis on Thursday, December 12th, with performances at 5 and 7:30 p.m. Dr. Culleton, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
This is an exciting time of year, I'm sure, for you.
Absolutely.
You are a director of the renowned Concordia Choir, about to, I guess, support and work with and present the 98th annual Christmas concert titled Our Eyes at Last Shall See Him. This is the 98th annual concert, Dr. Culleton.
It's the 98th, and it is the fifth one that I've been now in charge of as the artistic director of the Christmas concerts, but it's my 13th one as a faculty member. And I think back to 13 years of Christmas concerts, plus I did four as a student. And so 16 or 17 years of Christmas concerts in my life, pretty special.
What's this mean to the college?
Oh, without question, it's the largest event that the college puts on every single year. You know, it's one of the main events to bring people to our campus, to reconnect with alumni, families who have been near and dear to Concordia, and also to interact a lot with prospective students who are coming to see the concert. We time the concert along with one of our music scholarship weekend events. And so there will be many music scholarship finalists who are with us this weekend as well. And they're going to see the concert. And if they're like my wife, she grew up in Bismarck. She saw the Concordia Christmas concert, and that sold her. That hooked her into Concordia College at the right place for her. So, I mean, and also as a church of the Lutheran liberal arts tradition, it's kind of our honor and privilege to get to celebrate the birth of Christ through these annual Christmas concerts.
I think oftentimes many of us think of schools trying to attract prospective students in athletics, right? We don't necessarily think of schools doing that in the fine arts. So I was thinking when you were describing this, that this is kind of your Super Bowl, to use the metaphor.
You're not wrong. That's exactly what this feels like. And we kind of take over Memorial Auditorium on our campus for a week because it just takes that long to get the mural set up, to get all the platforms and the risers and the orchestra in place. And I think that's an apt thought, that this is kind of our Super Bowl.
The concert's titled Our Eyes at Last Shall See Him. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on the inspiration behind this theme and how it will be reflected in the performance?
Oh, for sure. I actually kind of reverse engineered this Christmas concert a little bit because we're very familiar. Anybody who even saw the Charlie Brown Christmas special many years ago is very familiar with the readings from the Gospel of Luke. They're kind of our traditional, most used Christmas readings. And what we don't often get to is the reading that kind of comes right after all of the Christmas readings. And this is the reading where an old man named Simeon encounters the baby Christ and Mary and Joseph in the temple. And Simeon had been made a promise by God that he would not die until he had encountered the Christ child. And so Simeon was led that moment into the temple by the Holy Spirit and met up with Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, and even some translations have Simeon at 230 years old and blind, and he encounters the baby Christ and holds him in his arms and says what we now know as the Song of Simeon, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation." And I have always loved that thought of a blind man encountering the baby Christ child and saying, "Mine eyes have seen thy salvation, and that promise you made me has now come to fruition and I can depart in peace. And so I thought about all of the ways that we sing or speak about sight and vision through all of our Christmas carols and the readings that we use from the Gospels and from other liturgical poetic sources like Susan Chirwin and Jan Richardson and just wonderful, wonderful poets. And we have put that as the thread for this year's concert, sight and vision. And for example, one of the first pieces that the choirs will sing all together is a beloved Christmas tune called Do You Hear What I Hear? And I know that that's a very familiar Christmas carol, but of course, one of the very first refrains says, Do you see what I see? And so, do you hear what I hear? Listen to what I say. All of these senses being brought into our Christmas experience. And so it's really been quite delightful to have that as a thread throughout the concert. And, you know, it's a Concordia Christmas concert. You're going to hear some of those beloved songs that you love to hear at Christmas time, that you love to sing along with at Christmas time. Silent Night is our annual big audience sing, and that's arranged by my predecessor, Renee Clausen. And because I like my job, we're going to continue to do Silent Night for many, many years to come. And Hark the Herald Angels Sing is on the program. And this year, we're tipping our cap to the Scandinavian traditions, and we're going to be presenting a suite of carols in Scandinavian languages. And, you know, interestingly, the number one piece that in my first 5 years now has been requested by audience members is this Norwegian carol called I Am So Glad Each Christmas Eve.
That surprises me.
Well, they hear a lot of the other ones on a pretty regular basis. You know, your O Come All Ye Faithful and Angels We Have Heard on High. Those are covered. But I did a little research on why does our audience even know this carol so much? Well, number one, of course, it's probably the most familiar or famous Norwegian Christmas hymn tune or carol. And so a lot of the Scandahoodians who come out to enjoy our concert wearing their native sweaters, they are familiar with I Am So Glad Each Christmas Eve through their own upbringing and their familial experiences of Christmas time. And so I went back and I looked through the programs of my predecessor's predecessor, Paul J. Christiansen, who conducted the Concordia Choir for 50 years. And that piece was a staple on the programs. And even Renee Clausen continued to do that. That was on several of his programs over his 34 years at Concordia. So it has surprised me, too, how many times that piece has been mentioned to me. But I thought, well, we're going to do it this year. And then not only that, but we'll follow it up with three other Scandinavian carols in their original languages. So wide variety. Our Eyes at Last Shall See Him. The mural this year by Paul Johnson is beautiful. And the centerpiece of it all is that story that I just mentioned about Simeon meeting Jesus and Mary and Joseph in the temple. And it's really quite a wonder to behold.
How do you collaborate with artists, Mr. Johnson?
Happily.
And I've seen the photos as what he's put together. It's beautiful. There's no other way for me to describe it.
Yeah, Paul is one of the greatest collaborators that I've ever had the pleasure of working with, and I've known him for all 13 of my years at Concordia. But to be able to work with him as the in my role as the artistic director for the last 5 years has been one of the most meaningful parts of my job. He is such a servant-minded, humble servant-minded artist. He wants his work on the mural to enhance the music that the choirs and the orchestra are performing, and to enhance the readings and the narrations that they're hearing. And so Paul and I, I think he would say the same story, but I think every December, by the time Christmas comes around, we're already talking a little bit about ideas for the next year. And sometimes we use a good number of them, and sometimes we move on from an idea. But we really, 12 months around the calendar, we're talking about the Christmas concert at some level. We get very serious. I usually have the theme in mind by March for the next year. And then by May or June, I've shared enough musical ideas with Paul that he's usually sketched out ideas for the mural. And we meet for lunch and he unveils them. And they're fantastic. I love seeing his hand-drawn artwork. The mural then goes from hand-drawing onto the computer program that he uses, and then it's printed right onto quarter-inch foam core and screwed onto the framing of the mural. It's about 150 feet long, and so it's many, many frames, pieces of 2x4s and plywood and all, and it gets screwed onto that. I mean, it's very fun to watch it because by the time somebody comes into the hall, the room looks beautiful. The mural is complete, but it is fun to be able to see it from the pencil drawings to the moments when it's being screwed onto the framing. And then Brian Duncan lights the thing beautifully. And I think that's, without question, one of the things that has set our Christmas concert experience apart from other college institutions is the fact that it's not only the music of the season, but the visual art and the theatrical lighting really makes for a very rewarding experience for the senses.
This must be one of the most renowned college presentations of a Christmas concert in the country. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. And I think part of the reason is you mentioned it coming into the show, 98th annual Christmas concert. And when you do something for that long, you just the legacy speaks for itself. And mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I'm very interested in considering on a yearly basis is what are new elements that we can bring into the Christmas concert? And what are the ways that we can continue to honor the tradition that has kept people coming back for so many years? And when we start selling our tickets, usually on a chilly morning in late October, there are people at the ticket window who have been coming to the concert for six decades. And always just touches my heart. I make sure to try to get over to that ticket office that morning that they open up and to meet those people and to see them again. But I think the legacy of it being 98 years in now has really made this a part of the Christmas season that a lot of people just simply refuse to go without.
There's also a virtual concert offering. Tell me about that.
Well, when COVID struck the Minnesota Orchestra, like it did all of our performing arts organizations, Orchestra Hall made this brilliant decision to put in some very high-quality cameras all around Orchestra Hall to capture their performances so that they could do digital concert offerings to their subscribers. And we are really fortunate to get to work with their team of videographers. And we capture the concerts down at Orchestra Hall. And then my colleague, Wyatt Steinke, who's the manager of the choral organizations at Concordia, as well as the executive producer of the Concordia Christmas Concerts, Wyatt works to edit those into a beautifully presented digital offering that people can order and purchase the virtual ticket for. And then it's available for unlimited viewings from usually right before Christmas until right after the New Year season. So this will be our fourth year of offering this. And it is a beautiful thing to be able to share with so many people all around the world the Christmas concert that took place just a week or two before. And it's special to me that we can now do that on a yearly basis. We've taped for public television many times over the years, but it is simply cost prohibitive. Whereas because the cameras already exist at Orchestra Hall and they have staff people who are specialists in capturing music events, it's just a dream to get to work with that team and to be able to sit back at home and watch that Christmas concert. And we watch it many times as a family, even though my family will see it several times. It's just wonderful to have it running throughout the holiday season at home.
Dr. Culleton, give me some insight. We talked a little bit earlier about what this means for students as a recruiting tool, but now you have 300 students who are experiencing this.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of the preparation, the commitment. Give us a behind-the-scenes peek at how these students are preparing for this concert.
Yeah. First of all, I have a four-word phrase that I say over and over, really from the time we return after Thanksgiving break through the end of the Christmas concert, and that is, you can do this. You know, if we sat and felt sorry for ourselves for how many hours we've been rehearsing for it, we might be overwhelmed. But for all of these years, students have been presenting successfully these Christmas concerts, and our current students do it as well as anybody. Really, the practices for Christmas concert begin early in October. Starting in early October, we spend every Wednesday together as one large choir, all of our choirs gathering as one large choir, to begin rehearsing our Christmas concert music in earnest. And one of the reasons we do what we call Mass Choir Wednesdays is because it builds that community of singers. We feel like we're one choral program instead of three big choirs doing our own thing. And we also learn our music so quickly. When you put that many gifted musicians in a room, those singers who are really fast sight readers can help those singers who need to hear their parts more than maybe others. And the fact we're all in the room together really makes it a communal experience for 2 months. And that we have felt that this year. The choirs rehearse 3 to 5 times a week. The Concordia Choir rehearses for 90 minutes every day, Monday through Friday. And Chapel Choir meets every day for 75 minutes. And Cantori meets every day for about an hour. So our youngest choir meets for about an hour. And we do it. And as we get closer to the Christmas concert, we come back after Thanksgiving. And on that Sunday night, we're in Memorial Auditorium without the orchestra. And we are learning our walking cues, how we're going to move, because we do move around that hall. We tell people, please stay in your seats, because you never know when a choir is going to come by at about 20 miles an hour right next to you. And so we do the walking rehearsal, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are rehearsals in the space with the orchestra. They've been going absolutely beautifully so far this year. And then tonight, Thursday night, we do our dress rehearsal, and as you mentioned earlier, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday concerts. The students are ready. The memorization is good. The music they're making feels very meaningful. I think the variety of music that we're singing, along with the familiar music that we're singing, is going to absolutely lift the spirits of our audience members and be exactly what they need as winter starts to really settle upon us here, and the season of Christmas and any other holidays that you're celebrating is upon us.
I'm sure it's not lost on you that you're approaching the centennial of this tradition.
Right. Yep.
What are your aspirations for the future, and how do you envision the centennial concert approaching?
Yeah, somebody had asked me a couple days ago, how far out do you start planning concerts? And I said, well, I keep a lot of spreadsheets. And you know, this is the 21st century. I hear a tune, you know, at some point in the year that I think would be great for Christmas concert. I've got the right database to put the title and the composer in. Same thing goes with the themes that we do for the Christmas concerts. But I've got a special file of ideas for the 100th anniversary concert. You know, we're going to celebrate that in a very large way. And we've had, I mentioned this really huge mural that we've got framing the choirs and the orchestra on a yearly basis. And it's a new mural every year. Well, we've had 3 or 4 artists over the 98 years who have been what I'd call the long-term mural artists. Cy Running started in 1940 and went through 1973. And so one of my dreams would be to digitally recreate one of Cy Running's murals and put that up along one of the side walls. And Dave Hetland was a very long time, 1978 to 2005, was our visual artist, mural designer. And same thing, would love to have another one of David's murals framing another one of the walls. And then Paul Johnson, our current artist, has been with us from 2009 on. This is his 16th mural with us. And so, you know, the current artist gets the front mural. It would be my... So I'm just sharing with all listeners a little bit of a dream right there. And if we can make that happen, that's one of the ways that I want to do it. And then, of course, want to do some of the absolute favorite pieces of music from the first century of Concordia Christmas concerts. And both of my predecessors were absolutely fantastic composers and arrangers. And so that concert will have a number of pieces by Rene Clausen and Paul J. Christiansen, no doubt performed by all of the singers and the students.
As we wrap up our conversation, I want to go back to the students. Mm-hmm. Is it still easy for you to recruit? And I ask that in the context of we often hear that the first programs that are cut from schools that are struggling are arts, music, and sometimes PE as well.
Yep.
And then we also have social media, and we have all of these time taxers on students as they're progressing through.
Yeah.
Has it changed your ability to recruit, or are you still really optimistic on the strength of the arts for the students who are coming to you?
I'm excited to say that Concordia College is the fastest growing college in Minnesota. I mean, our first year class this year saw an increase of around 25% over last year's first year class. And there, I think,
which is large, yeah.
Oh, it's a huge increase. You know, we went from around 435 to up to like 596 first year students. And so that's a very encouraging sign. And that increase isn't happening on accident. I'm really proud to say that the number of music majors, or the number of students that we're bringing in on music scholarship on a yearly basis, is one of the reasons we see that growth. I have colleagues in every area of the music department who are as committed as we are in the choral program to be out in schools and recruiting and meeting with prospective students when they come to campus. Recruiting is essential for all colleges. And we have just been very fortunate in the last year or two to have some compelling stories to share, some compelling new programs to offer to students. And, you know, you mentioned the apps and time and social media, the time killers. And I think Concordia made a great move a couple of years ago getting into e-games and being in an e-games, e-sports league and meeting those students where they're at. And we have a new president on campus. Colin Irvin is in his second year as the president of Concordia. And there is momentum like I have not felt at any point in my teaching and academic career. He is very committed to designing programs that meet our students of the 21st century where they are, and also then give them the great collegiate experience that they will need to have to be thoughtful members of communities and societies. And so we work very hard to recruit. I'm happy to say that those efforts are paying off, and I'm delighted that we have such a large group of music scholarship finalists coming to campus on Friday to both audition for scholarship and to see the Christmas concert that night. So it all goes hand in hand, and I'm really, really pleased with the momentum we're feeling, and I feel lucky to be a part of the process that brings students to the campus.
I almost hesitate to ask this question, but are there still tickets available?
Oh, yes. The great thing about Memorial Auditorium is we have our seating chart made, but we have room on the floor. If we have already added chairs for Saturday afternoon's concert on the floor. So we have capacity. You'll never hear me say that the concerts are sold out, because we do have some flexibility to try and get every single person who wants to be in that hall. And, you know, if you are looking for tickets, the easiest way to find them is visiting ConcordiaChristmas.com. I'm so pleased we got that website because it's so easy to remember. ConcordiaChristmas.com for ticket purchases. And yes, tickets available for all four of our performances this weekend.
Dr. Colison, I'm sad to say we're going to be on a train, my wife and I, heading east during the concerts. And I look forward to purchasing the virtual concert that you offer. And that will be a good way for our family to experience the great work that you do. Dr. Michael Colleton is an associate professor of music at Concordia College, and he puts together the fantastic Concordia Christmas concert that is this weekend. Thank you. Thank you so much,
yes.
Dr. Colleton, for
yes.
joining us on Main Street.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
The concert will be performed in Memorial Auditorium on the campus of Concordia College at 7:30 p.m. Friday, December 6th, at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, December 7th, and at 2 p.m. Sunday, December 8th. And then the concert will be taken on the road to Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis on Thursday, December 12th, with performances at 5 and 7:30 p.m. Coming after the break, Matt Ali shares his thoughts on Gladiator II, one of the films that's been the talk of the season. And later, Dave Thompson and I will recap this week's news. Stay tuned. Main Street will be right back after this.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'll tell you a story.
There's the Bill Haley music that we all look forward to. This man's going to tell us a story, and he does each and every day here on Prairie Public. Dave Thompson, the legend, our news director. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Glad to be here.
We're going to review this week's news, Dave. There's a lot of news. I want to start with the governor's presentation yesterday. You and I visited yesterday about the governor presenting his budget to the legislature. We've had 24 hours now. Any new reaction?
Okay, here is some of the reaction that I've heard. Remember the governor talking about this website that you can go put your address in and then you can look at property taxes. And then if you look at the park board, you can find out who's on the park board. You can contact them instead of the legislature.
Call the friend.
Yeah, call the friend thing, yeah. But, you know, I've heard from some legislators saying, yeah, that's all well and good. But when we knocked on doors campaigning this year, what was the first thing we heard complaints about was property taxes. And the Senate Majority Leader Dave Hoge said he's going ahead with, you know, plans that will include caps on what local governments can charge in property taxes, caps on the mill levy and on your mill levy increases. There are also proposals in the legislature to do away with that mill levy concept and go with dollars only so that you get more of an idea of what a mill is.
I'm using air quotes here. Market conduct examination finds shortfalls in how the North Dakota Insurance Reserve Fund handles claims. What's new about this, Dave?
Well, what's new about this is that it was all kind of sparked by what happened in Mandan. Mandan had a water main break and it flooded a number of homes, and the homeowners were not satisfied that they, you know, they got a fair settlement from the North Dakota Insurance Reserve Fund, the NIDRF, which is basically the one that insures the political subdivisions. So the insurance department took a look at it, conducted this market conduct examination, and found some deficiencies in what they were doing. The insurance department did not want to point fingers saying this was right or this was wrong, but they said there's a few things missing when you come up with what kind of settlement you get to somebody who's been injured by something like that or being hit by a city car or something like that. So they said that the NIDRF fund has to do a better job of a paper trail, make sure you have better explanations about why you approved or denied these claims. And they're going to start doing that. The new CEO of NIDRF, NDIRF, the North Dakota Insurance Reserve Fund, says that he wants to work with the insurance department to make it more transparent and more searchable, that you have a paper trail, that you have reasons why these decisions were made.
Before we move on, Dave, and I need to see whether this threshold level has changed, but while I was in Wyoming, Wyoming had the Governmental Claims Act, and it didn't matter what your claim was, the maximum amount you could claim for damages was $250,000. I think that's been raised to $500,000, but still, I play out in my mind the horrible tragedy of, let's say, a city vehicle hitting a child or something where there is negligence or fault, and all the state of Wyoming at the time would have paid would have been $250,000. So this is a big, big issue. And the state needs to, and local governments and political subdivisions need to be fair in how they compensate when these accidents happen.
Absolutely correct. And that's the concern that these complainants brought, you know, from Mandan and from other situations. So there is an effort to improve, you know, the steps that the NIDRF is going to take before they issue what they're going to give in terms of kind of settlement dollars.
Sure.
I do not believe there is a cap on the settlement dollars in North Dakota.
Dave, Burley County State's Attorney said this. He said the county auditor treasurer may have violated the federal Hatch Act. And as a public employee in my past, I know what that is. It's hands off when it comes to elections.
That's right. And the charge on this is against our auditor treasurer, Mark Sponskowski, who is elected. He was in his office during business hours, and he was texting, and they said that he texted 66 times, "Don't vote for Brian Bittner," who is the chairman of the county commission. Now, if they find out that he has violated the Hatch Act, then the county could be fined up to twice his yearly salary in loss federal grants, which I think is very, very interesting. There's more to this, and there's going to be more discussion on that. I guess that the next Burley County Commission meeting, there's going to be more discussion about what might happen.
Dave, the soybean harvest was good, but now there are really concerns about prices, and there have been concerns about prices, but now tariffs has entered the picture.
This is your classic good news, bad news scenario, isn't it? The good news is we had a good soybean harvest and the bins are full. But the bad news is the prices were so low that farmers are holding on to the crop to get better prices. There's a farm bill that still has not been settled. And then there's the threat of tariffs. And when the tariffs were put on foreign countries, some countries retaliated by saying, we're not going to buy soybeans from the United States, we'll buy it from Brazil. And right. They lost some market share. Well, now that market share is back. So there is some concern among the soybean growers that tariffs might hurt them a lot.
Dave, there have been lots of barriers to a natural gas pipeline to bring Bakken gas to other parts of North Dakota. The legislature is willing to spend a lot of money to do this.
Right.
What are the current barriers?
Well, here's the main barrier is you need a constant large customer who needs a lot of natural gas in order to make it economic to build this pipeline from the Bakken, say, to Grand Forks or something like that. You need a customer that's going to be a reliable user of natural gas. That's first. Then you have some issues with what they call the last mile. The last mile being taking gas from the main pipeline and bringing it into a town and getting the infrastructure set in the town to bring the natural gas to homes. That's an expensive project too. So those are the things that are barriers right now to getting natural gas from the Bakken into parts of central and eastern North Dakota that are actually hoping to get some natural gas, but they do need that big user.
What are you and your team working on?
Well, there was a discussion about replacing drones that the governor mentioned in his budget address. He mentioned that they were going to replace a bunch of drones that were Chinese-made with American-made drones, and then they're going to be doing some upgrades in terms of, you know, scanning the skies because you've got these unmanned vehicles beyond the line of sight. You need a better tracking device of where aircraft are so you can avoid those aircraft.
No better place to do that research than right here in North Dakota.
Absolutely.
We are really a leader when it comes to drones. Dave Thompson, he and I review the news each and every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, I wish you a good week.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
Madeline reviews Gladiator 2. That's next.
The Minot Chamber Chorale cordially invites you to a Renaissance Christmas feast featuring familiar holiday tunes from years past, as well as new pieces from the likes of Kim Andre Anderson, Edvard Evers, and more. Performances run December 6th and 7th at 7 p.m. at the Regency Event Center in downtown Minot. Tickets must be purchased in advance and are available by phone at 701-500-8810 or online at minotchamberchorale.org.
There's the fanfare that we hear each and every Thursday here on Main Street. It means one thing and one thing only. It's time to go to the movies with our good friend, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Well, Matt, you have Gladiator 2 for us. It's one of the movies that's been planned to be a big release during the holiday season. Let's listen to the trailer.
Strength and honor!
It is an art.
Choosing gladiators.
They're usually prisoners of war.
I claim this city for the glory of Rome.
You have something in you. Rage.
Never let it go. It will carry you to greatness.
I own you now.
But whose head could I give you to satisfy your fury?
The general will do. Rome has taken everything from me. But I will have my vengeance.
There is plenty of pain waiting for you in the next life. I don't know why you are so greedy for it in this one.
Your Majesties.
This is your gladiator.
It is.
I have the trust of the Emperor.
It will clear my path to the throne.
You will be my instrument.
I will never be your instrument. In this life or the next.
Lucius, take your father's strength. His name was Maximus. And I see him in you.
Most fighters won't survive.
You must help him.
Strength
Demona!
I don't fight for power. I fight the free roam for men like them.
Your name will be forgotten!
To restore order, I must have power.
Everything is forgotten in time. Empires fall, so do emperors.
This is war! Real war!
The odds are against you.
The odds are always against me.
Ready to ramp!
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. What did you think of the movie?
Liked it, didn't love it. It is about 2.5 hours long. Again, directed by Ridley Scott, 87 years old, as spry an 80-plus-year-old man as you'll find, along with Mick Jagger probably, on Earth right now. He's still cranking them out. Of course, he directed Gladiator in 2000, which won Best Picture. Scott has yet to win the directing Oscar, Craig, curiously enough, and I don't know that it's going to happen here. I do expect an honorary Oscar for him any year now. It's a little slow. I found the pacing to be slow, and it does pick up, you know, once we get into the Colosseum stuff and Lucius, played by Paul Mescal, who's coming off his big success in the movie Aftersun 2 years ago, and he's emerging as a big star now. He plays Lucius. He's the main character. There's a lot of tentacles to Russell Crowe's character. I'm not going to reveal those in this review. You have to go see it. But there is a connection to the first film and Crowe's famous Oscar-winning role as Maximus in the first film that we all remember. But the pacing is a bit slow, and there's a lot of connections you have to connect between Pedro Pascal, who plays the current general of the Roman armies. There are these new emperors that are running the show, these twin brothers, played by Joseph Quinn and Fred Etchinger, and they are ridiculous. I mean, they are not the performances. They're these twin emperors who are the typical, you know, ridiculous emperors. They're not the emperors who should be in charge. They're silly, and they just love seeing people get eaten by tigers in the Colosseum and all this kind of stuff. So, long story short, Paul Mescal gets taken prisoner early in the film. He is living in Africa, and the Romans come, and there's a big battle, and Pedro Pascal's armies capture a bunch of people, and he's, you know, he's brought to Rome. He becomes a gladiator. He works for Denzel Washington, who's this gladiator trainer, and Denzel chews the scenery in a performance that's probably going to get him another Oscar nomination. I expect Mescal to be in the best actor mix, Washington in the supporting actor mix. So that all takes a while to get moving, and then from there we get a lot of Colosseum stuff. Heavy CGI, there's giant rhinos, there's sharks. I mean, every possible creature is unleashed in the Colosseum to battle Paul Mescal's Lucius character and all these other slaves that he has befriended and he's trying to organize for a revolt. Does that sound similar to the first film? Yes, it does. So there's all this backstory, but keeping it going is, who is Paul Mescal? Who is Lucius? How does he connect to Russell Crowe's character? How does he connect to Pedro Pascal's wife? It's all kind of has to be figured out like a mystery with a lot of CGI and a lot of action. There's a great finale near the end, I would say. But I think the thing is, Craig, it's a good film, but there's not this iconic moment. Everybody remembers the iconic moment from Gladiator 1, right, Craig? It's when Russell Crowe rips off that mask in the Colosseum and says to Joaquin Phoenix, "I am Maximus Decimus, blah, 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 commander of the legions, husband to a murdered wife, father to a murdered son, and I'll have my revenge in this life or the next." That's the moment, right? There's not that moment in this film. There's moments like that, but it's hard to recreate something like that. Mescal is not the charismatic star that Russell Crowe is or was. He's a very good actor, but there's something just kind of missing. And it's not that it's a sequel, because Godfather 2 is every bit as good as Godfather 1. But it's a good film. It just gets a little long. The CGI is a little bit over the top. And as good as Mescal is, he's not Russell Crowe.
So is there any natural continuation from the first film, Matt, or is this just chart a whole new direction?
There is continuation. I don't want to reveal plot points because they're important. So this takes place approximately 20 years after the first film ends. So you can do the math there. There's still memories of Marcus Aurelius as emperor. There's memories of the Joaquin Phoenix emperor character who Crow famously kills in the first film because he challenges him to a duel. And Crow is like, you want to fight me? you know what's going to happen, right? Joaquin Phoenix has bit off more than he can chew. So yeah, there are connections to the previous film. It takes a while to get those in motion, Craig, and it takes a lot of concentration from the audience. You really have to concentrate in this movie as to who is who, what's the connection, what's the connection to Crow's character. There's this guy coming in who knew Crow's character. What is Lucius's relationship to Russell Crowe's character? We don't know. You have to find this out, and it takes a little bit of concentration. So I want to urge my listeners, if you're going to go, you got to be locked in for about 2 hours and 25 minutes.
The original Gladiator score by Hans Zimmer, that really was iconic. Does this sequel's music evoke the same power and emotion? It must be integral to this film's storytelling, I would guess.
It's integral, but it doesn't overpower the film, I would say. That's the best I could say to that. So,
well, do you think fans liked it, Matt? Has it performed well?
It's performed well, not as well as Wicked. As you know, it was paired with Wicked in the same Thanksgiving, time frame. The Glicked weekend, they called it. Wicked definitely emerged as the bigger film, but for a 2.5-hour Gladiator Roman epic, it certainly has done well. I think it's over $100 million now domestic, but I'd have to check my figures on that. And, we all grew up watching these sword and sandal epics, right, Craig? Spartacus, El Cid, Fall of the Roman Empire. And there's a majesty to a film about Rome. I think it still kind of evokes a lot of images. And, of course, we just accept that Romans talked in British accents, right? That's typically how it was in Spartacus. All of the Romans are played by British actors, and of course the slaves are played by American actors. The irony there not lost, of course, with Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis as the slaves. But this is certainly a good film. I don't know that historically it'll be remembered as well as Gladiator 1 or Spartacus or something like that. But I do urge people to see it. There's going to be a lot of Oscar nominations from this movie. Denzel Washington in his supporting actor role, that's an interesting performance because you're not sure what side this guy is on. So that's another thing you need to pay attention to is Washington's role. What side is he on, the emperor's side, or is he plotting an overthrow of these twin emperors? We're not really sure. But Denzel could win his third Oscar. This would be Oscar number 3 if he wins. I'm not really sure how the supporting actor race is going. I do think Edward Norton in the Bob Dylan film, A Complete Unknown, where he plays Pete Seeger, I do think he'll be nominated as well. And I just saw that movie, and I will talk about it next week, by the way, for listeners. But Denzel Choose the Scenery, and this could be Oscar number 3 for Denzel, who's talked openly about retiring soon.
Matt, in your opinion, does Gladiator 2 work with fans of the original Gladiator, or have people become a little divided after this movie?
I think most people will say part 1 was better, but the fact that it's making this much money means people are interested in seeing it, right? I don't know that historically it'll go down as great as the first movie did. Russell Crowe wins the Oscar, it wins Best Picture. Scott famously did not win the directing Oscar, even though it got Best Picture. It went to Steven Soderbergh for Traffic that year. So I think part 1 will be remembered better. But the fact that this is making so much money, there is an audience for a sword and sandal old time epic out there.
Did the momentum of Wicked surprise you at all? I have a feeling it didn't.
No, it didn't. I was nervous about Ariana Grande with the casting as Galinda, but she pulled it off. I think Cynthia Erivo, I think, is the front runner to win Best Actress, along with Mikey Madison from Anora, which we reviewed earlier last month. So not surprising. I think there is a taste still to go to the theater. A lot of people sit at home and watch Netflix and watch streaming, and I have lots of friends who do that. That's not my style. I want to go to the theater and see it on the big screen.
We know that Russell Crowe won't win an Academy Award like he did in Maximus in the original Gladiator, but if he would have been nominated, if he were to be nominated, has that ever happened before in film history where an actor has been nominated at least twice for playing the same role.
Yes. So Bing Crosby did it for Going My Way in 44, and again the next year for The Bells of St. Mary's, right? That's one of them?
That's correct. That's okay. Father Chuck O'Malley.
Father O'Malley. Paul Newman in The Hustler, 1961. Later comes back to play Fast Eddie Felsen in The Color of Money in 1986 and finally wins his only Oscar, correct? Is that one, another one?
That's two. We got one more.
Peter O'Toole as Henry II in Beckett, 1964, plays him again in The Lion in Winter in 1968.
I did not have him on my list.
That is one of them, Craig.
Way to go.
And finally, Al Pacino as Michael Corleone in Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. Is that about everybody?
Boy, that's four of the three that I had, Matt. Okay. So congratulations.
I got four out of three. Okay. O'Toole is one of them. Yes, he is.
We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lee.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Daybook for December 5th. The process to ratify a constitutional amendment is complicated and time-consuming. The Archivist of the United States, who heads the National Archives and Records Administration, oversees the procedure. Congress can propose an amendment by a two-thirds majority in both the House and Senate. Alternatively, two-thirds of the states can call for a constitutional convention, though no amendment has ever been proposed in that manner. Once an amendment passes Congress, it must be approved by three-fourths of the states. The 18th Amendment, which established prohibition, went into effect on January 16, 1919, marking the beginning of the prohibition era. The amendment banned the manufacture, transportation, and sale of intoxicating liquors. This did not cause much change in North Dakota, as the state had entered the Union as a dry state in 1889. Prohibition was not widely popular in North Dakota, and there were plenty of bootleggers supplying blind pigs where alcohol was sold. However, opponents of alcohol were well organized, particularly through the Women's Christian Temperance Union and ministerial associations, and prohibition was firmly established in the state. From Maine to Oregon, many other states like North Dakota had officially prohibited alcohol and welcomed the amendment. The Roaring Twenties went into full swing, but prohibition failed to deliver on its promise of creating a more sober society. Speakeasies were packed every night with patrons who danced and drank to excess. Proponents of prohibition were sorely disappointed. Prohibition did not last long. On this date, in 1933, the 21st Amendment was ratified, repealing the 18th Amendment. Nevertheless, prohibition did not disappear overnight. Arthur J. Gronow, who was running for state attorney general, reminded North Dakotans that prohibition remained on the books in the state. He asserted that anyone selling liquor in North Dakota would be prosecuted. North Dakotans set new records for voter turnout in the 1936 election, spurred by a highly contested race for governor, which saw William Langer return to office. Perhaps it was no coincidence that alcohol was also on the ballot. Voters passed a measure that moved the state from dry to wet in that election. Today's Dakota Daybook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Daybook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
A member of the world's biggest K-pop girl group is striking out on her own. Blackpink's Rosé has a solo album.
It was about time, like, we should go out, explore, do everything we want and need to do.
Rosé talks about finding her own voice on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, join Jeremy Hobson for The Middle. This week, Jeremy explores America's loneliness epidemic and what can we do to fix it. And at 7 p.m. it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, thank you for spending part of your day with us. Have a wonderful North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you back here Monday on Main Street.